They discovered, the morning after the People's Mortgage Company collapsed, was that Mark Yontz had sold the 20th Century Motor Factory to a bunch of suckers from South Dakota, and that he'd also given it as collateral for a loan from a bank in Illinois. And when they took a look at the factory, they discovered that he'd moved all the machinery out and sold it piecemeal, God only knows where and to whom. So it seems like everybody owns the place, and nobody. That's how it stands now. The South Dakotans and the bank and the attorney for the creditors of the People's Mortgage Company all suing one another, all claiming this factory, and nobody having the right to move a wheel in it, except that there's no wheels left to move. Did Mark Yontz operate the factory before he sold it? Lord, no, ma'am. He wasn't the kind that ever operates anything. He didn't want to make money, only to get it. Guess he got it, too, more than anyone could have made out of that factory. He wondered why the blonde, hard-faced man who sat with the woman in front of his desk looked grimly out the window at their car, at a large object wrapped in canvas, roped tightly under the raised cover of the car's luggage compartment. What happened to the factory records? Which do you mean, ma'am? Their production records, their work records, their personnel files. Oh, there's nothing left of that now. There's been a lot of looting going on. All the mixed owners grabbed what furniture or things they could haul out of there, even if the sheriff did put a padlock on the door. The papers and stuff like that, I guess it was all taken by the scavengers from Starnesville. That's the place down in the valley where they're having it pretty tough these days. They burned the stuff for kindling, most likely.
Is there anyone left here who used to work in the factory? Asked Reardon.
No, sir, not around here. They all live down in Starnesville.
All of them? Whispered Dagny. She was thinking of the ruins. The engineers, too?
Yes, ma'am. That was the factory town. They've all gone, long ago.
Do you happen to remember the names of any men who worked there?
No, ma'am.
What owner was the last to operate the factory? Asked Reardon.
I couldn't say, sir. There's been so much trouble up there, and the place has changed hands so many times. Since old Jed Starnes died. He's the man who built the factory. He made this whole part of the country, I guess. He died 12 years ago.
Can you give us the names of all the owners since?
No, sir. We had a fire in the old courthouse about 3 years ago, and all the old records are gone. I don't know where you could trace them now.
You don't know how this Mark Yontz happened to acquire the factory?
Yes, I know that. He bought it from Mayor Bascom of Rome. How Mayor Bascom happened to own it, I don't know.
Where is Mayor Bascom now?
Still there, in Rome.
Thank you very much, said Reardon, rising. We'll call on him.
They were at the door when the clerk asked,
What is it you're looking for, sir?
We're looking for a friend of ours, said Reardon. A friend we've lost, who used to work in that factory.
Mayor Bascom of Rome, Wisconsin, leaned back in his chair. His chest and stomach formed a pear-shaped outline under his soiled shirt. The air was a mixture of sun and dust, pressing heavily upon the porch of his house. He waved his arm, the ring on his finger flashing a large topaz of poor quality.
No use. No use, lady. Absolutely no use, he said. Would be just a waste of your time trying to question the folks around here. There's no factory people left, and nobody that would remember much about them. So many families have moved away that what's left here is plain no good, if I do say so myself, plain no good. Just being mayor of a bunch of trash.
He had offered chairs to his two visitors, but he did not mind it if the lady preferred to stand at the porch railing. He leaned back, studying her long-lined figure. High-class merchandise, he thought. But then the man with her was obviously rich. Dagny stood looking at the streets of Rome. There were houses, sidewalks, lampposts, even a sign advertising soft drinks. But they looked as if it were only now a matter of inches and hours before the town would reach the stage of Starnesville.
No, there's no factory records left, said Mayor Bascom. If that's what you want to find, lady, give it up. It's like chasing leaves in a storm now, just like leaves in a storm. Who cares about papers? At a time like this, what people save is good, solid material objects. One's got to be practical.
Through the dusty window panes, they could see the living room of his house. There were Persian rugs on a buckled wooden floor, a portable bar with chromium strips against a wall stained by the seepage of last year's rains, an expensive radio with an old kerosene lamp placed on top of it.
"Sure, it's me that sold the factory to Mark Yance. Mark was a nice fellow, a nice, lively, energetic fellow. Sure, he did trim a few corners, but who doesn't? Of course, he went a bit too far. That I didn't expect. I thought he was smart enough to stay within the law, whatever's left of it nowadays."
Mayor Bascom smiled, looking at them in a manner of placid frankness. His eyes were shrewd, without intelligence, his smile good-natured, without kindness.
"I don't think you folks are detectives," he said. "But even if you were, it wouldn't matter to me. I didn't get any rake off from Mark. He didn't let me in on any of his deals. I haven't any idea where he's gone to now."
He sighed.
"I liked that fellow. Wish he'd stayed around. Never mind the Sunday sermons. He had to live, didn't he? He was no worse than anybody, only smarter. Some get caught at it and some don't. That's the only difference. Nope, I didn't know what he was going to do with it when he bought that factory. Sure, he paid me quite a bit more than the old booby trap was worth. Sure, he was doing me a favor when he bought it. Nope, I didn't put any pressure on him to make him buy it. Wasn't necessary. I'd done him a few favors before. There's plenty of laws that's sort of made of rubber, and a mayor's in a position to stretch them a bit for a friend. Well, what the hell? That's the only way anybody ever gets rich in this world."
He glanced at the luxurious black car.
"As you ought to know."
"You were telling us about the factory," said Reardon, trying to control himself.
"What I can't stand," said Mayor Bascom, "is people who talk about principles. No principle ever filled anybody's milk bottle. The only thing that counts in life is solid material assets. It's no time for theories when everything is falling to pieces around us. Well, me, I don't aim to go under. Let them keep their ideas, and I'll take the factory. I don't want ideas. I just want my 3 square meals a day."
"Why did you buy that factory?"
"Why does anybody buy any business? To squeeze whatever can be squeezed out of it. I know a good chance when I see it. It was a bankruptcy sale, and nobody much who'd want to bid on the old mess. So I got the place for peanuts. Didn't have to hold it long, either. Mark took it off my hands in 2-3 months. Sure, it was a smart deal, if I say so myself. No big business tycoon could have done any better with it."
"Was the factory operating when you took it over?"
"No, it was shut down."
"Did you attempt to reopen it?"
"Not me. I'm a practical person."
"Can you recall the names of any men who worked there?"
"Nope, never met them."
"Did you move anything out of the factory?"
"Well, I'll tell you. I took a look around, and what I liked was old Jed's desk, old Jed Starnes. He was a real big shot in his time. Wonderful desk, solid mahogany, so I carted it home. And some executive, don't know who he was, had a stall shower in his bathroom, the like of which I never saw. A glass door with a mermaid cut in the glass, real artwork, and hot stuff too, hotter than any oil painting. So I had that shower lifted and moved here. What the hell, I owned it, didn't I? I was entitled to get something valuable out of that factory."
"Whose bankruptcy sale was it when you bought the factory?"
"Oh, that was the big crash of the Community National Bank in Madison. Boy, was that a crash. It just about finished the whole state of Wisconsin. Sure finished this part of it. Some say it was this motor factory that broke the bank, but others say it was only the last drop in a leaking bucket, because the Community National had bum investments all over 3 or 4 states. Eugene Lawson was the head of it. The banker with a heart, they called him. He was quite famous in these parts 2-3 years ago.
"Did Lawson operate the factory?"
"No, he merely lent an awful lot of money on it. More than he could ever hope to get back out of the old dump. When the factory busted, that was the last straw for Gene Lawson. The bank busted 3 months later.
He sighed.
"It hit the folks pretty hard around here. They all had their life savings in the Community National."
Mayor Bascom looked regretfully past his porch railing at his town. He jerked his thumb at a figure across the street. It was a white-haired charwoman, moving painfully on her knees, scrubbing the steps of a house.
"See that woman, for instance? They used to be solid, respectable folks. Her husband owned the dry goods store he worked all his life to provide for her in her old age, and he did it, too, by the time he died. Only the money was in the Community National Bank, who operated the factory when it failed. Oh, that was some quickie corporation called Amalgamated Service Incorporated, just a puffball. Came up out of nothing and went back to it. Where are its members? Where are the pieces of a puffball when it bursts? Try and trace them all over the United States. Try it. Where is Eugene Lawson? Oh, him? He's done all right. He's got a job in Washington, in the Bureau of Economic Planning and Natural Resources.
Reardon rose too fast, thrown to his feet by a jolt of anger. Then said, controlling himself,
"Thank you for the information." "You're welcome, friend, you're welcome," said Mayor Bascom placidly. "I don't know what it is you're after, but take my word for it. Give it up. There's nothing more to be had out of that factory."
"I told you that we are looking for a friend of ours."
"Well, have it your way. Must be a pretty good friend if you'll go to so much trouble to find him. You and the charming lady who is not your wife."
Dagny saw Reardon's face go white, so that even his lips became a sculptured feature, indistinguishable against his skin.
"Keep your dirty," he began, but she stepped between them.
"Why do you think that I'm not his wife?" she asked calmly. Mayor Bascom looked astonished by Reardon's reaction. He had made the remark without malice, merely like a fellow cheat, displaying his shrewdness to his partners in guilt.
"Lady, I've seen a lot in my lifetime," he said good-naturedly. "Married people don't look as if they have a bedroom on their minds when they look at each other. In this world, either you're virtuous or you enjoy yourself. Not both, lady. Not both."
"I've asked him a question," she said to Reardon in time to silence him. "He's given me an instructive explanation."
"If you want a tip, lady," said Mayor Bascom, "get yourself a wedding ring from the dime store and wear it. It's not surefire, but it helps."
"Thank you," she said. "Goodbye." The stern, stressed calm of her manner was a command that made Reardon follow her back to their car in silence. They were miles beyond the town when he said, not looking at her, his voice desperate and low,
"Dagny, Dagny, Dagny, I'm sorry."
"I'm not." Moments later, when she saw the look of control returning to his face, she said, "Don't ever get angry at a man for stating the truth."
"That particular truth was none of his business."
"His particular estimate of it was none of your concern or mine." He said through his teeth, not as an answer, but as if the single thought battering his brain turned into sounds against his will,
"I couldn't protect you from that unspeakable little—"
"I didn't need protection." He remained silent, not looking at her. "Hank, when you're able to keep down the anger, tomorrow or next week, give some thought to that man's explanation, and see if you recognize any part of it." He jerked his head to glance at her, but said nothing. When he spoke a long time later, it was only to say in a tired, even voice,
"We can't call New York and have our engineers come here to search the factory. We can't meet them here. We can't let it be known that we found the motor together. I had forgotten all that. Up there, in the laboratory."
"Let me call Eddie when we find a telephone. I'll have him send two engineers from the Taggart staff. I'm here alone on my vacation, for all they'll know or have to know." They drove 200 miles before they found a long-distance telephone line. When she called Eddie Willers, he gasped, hearing her voice. "Dagny, for God's sake, where are you?" "In Wisconsin. Why?"
"I didn't know where to reach you."
"You'd better come back at once, as fast as you can." "What happened?" "Nothing yet. But there are things going on which—"
"You'd better stop them now, if you can, if anybody can."
"What things? Haven't you been reading the newspapers?"
"No."
"I can't tell you over the phone. I can't give you all the details. Dagny, you'll think I'm insane, but I think they're planning to kill Colorado." "I'll come back at once," she said. Cut into the granite of Manhattan under the Taggart Terminal,
There were tunnels which had once been used as sidings at a time when traffic ran in clicking currents through every artery of the terminal every hour of the day. The need for space had shrunk through the years with the shrinking of the traffic, and the side tunnels had been abandoned like dry riverbeds. A few lights remained as blue patches on the granite over rails left to rust on the ground. Dagny placed the remnant of the motor into a vault in one of the tunnels. The vault had once contained an emergency electric generator, which had been removed long ago. She did not trust the useless young men of the Taggart research staff. There were only two engineers of talent among them who could appreciate her discovery. She had shared her secret with the two and sent them to search the factory in Wisconsin. Then she had hidden the motor where no one else would know of its existence. When her workers carried the motor down to the vault and departed, she was about to follow them and lock the steel door. But she stopped, key in hand, as if the silence and solitude had suddenly thrown her at the problem she had been facing for days, as if this were the moment to make her decision. Her office car was waiting for her at one of the terminal platforms, attached to the end of a train due to leave for Washington in a few minutes. She had made an appointment to see Eugene Lawson, but she had told herself that she would cancel it and postpone her quest if she could think of some action to take against the things she had found on her return to New York, the things Eddie begged her to fight. She had tried to think, but she could see no way of fighting, no rules of battle, no weapons. Helplessness was a strange experience, new to her. She had never found it hard to face things and make decisions, but she was not dealing with things. This was a fog without shapes or definitions, in which something kept forming and shifting before it could be seen, like semi-clots in a not-quite-liquid. It was as if her eyes were reduced to side vision, and she were sensing blurs of disaster coiling toward her. But she could not move her glance. She had no glance to move and focus. The Union of Locomotive Engineers was demanding that the maximum speed of all trains on the John Galt Line be reduced to 60 miles an hour. The Union of Railway Conductors and Brakemen was demanding that the length of all freight trains on the John Galt Line be reduced to 60 cars. The states of Wyoming, New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona were demanding that the number of trains run in Colorado not exceed the number of trains run in each of these neighboring states. A group headed by Orrin Boyle was demanding the passage of a preservation of livelihood law, which would limit the production of Reardon metal to an amount equal to the output of any other steel mill of equal plant capacity. A group headed by Mr. Moen was demanding the passage of a fair share law to give every customer who wanted it an equal supply of Reardon metal. A group headed by Bertram Scudder was demanding the passage of a public stability law forbidding eastern business firms to move out of their states. Wesley Mooch, top coordinator of the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources, was issuing a great many statements, the content and purpose of which could not be defined, except that the words emergency powers and unbalanced economy kept appearing in the text every few lines. Dagny, by what right? Eddie Willers had asked her, his voice quiet, but the words sounding like a cry. By what right are they all doing it? By what right? She had confronted James Taggart in his office and said, Jim, this is your battle. I've fought mine. You're supposed to be an expert at dealing with the looters. Stop them. Taggart had said, not looking at her, you can't expect to run the national economy to suit your own convenience. I don't want to run the national economy. I want your national economy runners to leave me alone. I have a railroad to run, and I know what's going to happen to your national economy if my railroad collapses. I see no necessity for panic. Jim, do I have to explain to you that the income from our Rio Norte line is all we've got to save us from collapsing? That we need every penny of it? Every fare? Every carload of freight? As fast as we can get it? He had not answered. When we have to use every bit of power in every one of our broken-down diesels, when we don't have enough of them to give Colorado the service it needs, what's going to happen if we reduce the speed and the length of trains? Well, there's something to be said for the union's viewpoint, too. With so many railroads closing and so many railroad men out of work, they feel that those extra speeds you've established on the Rio Norte line are unfair. They feel that there should be more trains instead, so that the work would be divided around. They feel that it's not fair for us to get all the benefit of that new rail,
They want a share of it, too.
Who wants a share of it? In payment for what?
He had not answered.
Who will bear the cost of two trains doing the work of one?
He had not answered.
Where are you going to get the cars and the engines?
He had not answered.
What are those men going to do after they've put Taggart Transcontinental out of existence?
I fully intend to protect the interests of Taggart Transcontinental.
How?
He had not answered.
How? If you kill Colorado?
It seems to me that before we worry about giving some people a chance to expand, we ought to give some consideration to the people who need a chance of bare survival.
If you kill Colorado, what is there going to be left for your damn looters to survive on?
You have always been opposed to every progressive social measure. I seem to remember that you predicted disaster when we passed the anti-dog-eat-dog rule. But the disaster has not come.
Because I saved you, you rotten fools. I won't be able to save you this time.
He had shrugged, not looking at her.
And if I don't, who will?
He had not answered. It did not seem real to her here under the ground. Thinking of it here, she knew she could have no part in Jim's battle. There was no action she could take against the men of undefined thought, of unnamed motives, of unstated purposes, of unspecified morality. There was nothing she could say to them. Nothing would be heard or answered. What were the weapons, she thought, in a realm where reason was not a weapon any longer? It was a realm she could not enter. She had to leave it to Jim and count on his self-interest. Dimly, she felt the chill of a thought, telling her that self-interest was not Jim's motive. She looked at the object before her, a glass case containing the remnant of the motor. The man who made the motor. She thought suddenly, the thought coming like a cry of despair. She felt a moment's helpless longing to find him, to lean against him and let him tell her what to do. A mind like his would know the way to win this battle. She looked around her. In the clean, rational world of the underground tunnels, nothing was of so urgent an importance as the task of finding the man who made the motor. She thought, could she delay it in order to argue with Orrin Boyle, to reason with Mr. Moen, to plead with Bertram Scudder? She saw the motor completed, built into an engine that pulled a train of 200 cars down a track of Reardon metal at 200 miles an hour. When the vision was within her reach, within the possible, was she to give it up and spend her time bargaining about 60 miles and 60 cars? She could not descend to an existence where her brain would explode under the pressure of forcing itself not to outdistance incompetence. She could not function to the rule of pipe down, keep down, slow down. Don't do your best, it is not wanted. She turned resolutely and left the vault to take the train for Washington. It seemed to her as she locked the steel door that she heard a faint echo of steps. She glanced up and down the dark curve of the tunnel. There was no one in sight. There was nothing but a string of blue lights glistening on walls of damp granite. Reardon could not fight the gangs who demanded the laws. The choice was to fight them or to keep his mills open. He had lost his supply of iron ore. He had to fight one battle or the other. There was no time for both. He had found on his return that a scheduled shipment of ore had not been delivered. No word or explanation had been heard from Larkin. When summoned to Reardon's office, Larkin appeared 3 days later than the appointment made, offering no apology. He said, not looking at Reardon, his mouth drawn tightly into an expression of rancorous dignity, "After all, you can't order people to come running to your office any time you please." Reardon spoke slowly and carefully. "Why wasn't the ore delivered?"
"I won't take abuse. I simply won't take any abuse for something I couldn't help. I can run a mine just as well as you ran it, every bit as well. I did everything you did. I don't know why something keeps going wrong unexpectedly all the time. I can't be blamed for the unexpected."
"To whom did you ship your ore last month?"
"I intended to ship you your share of it. I fully intended it. But I couldn't help it. If we lost 10 days of production last month on account of the rainstorm in the whole north of Minnesota, I intended to ship you the ore, so you can't blame me because my intention was completely honest."
"If one of my blast furnaces goes down,
Will I be able to keep it going by feeding your intention into it? That's why nobody can deal with you or talk to you, because you're inhuman. I've just learned that for the last 3 months you have not been shipping your ore by the lake boats. You have been shipping it by rail. Why?
Well, after all, I have a right to run my business as I see fit.
Why are you willing to pay the extra cost?
What do you care? I'm not charging it to you.
What will you do when you find that you can't afford the rail rates and that you have destroyed the lake shipping?
I am sure you wouldn't understand any consideration other than dollars and cents, but some people do consider their social and patriotic responsibilities.
What responsibilities?
Well, I think that a railroad like Taggart Transcontinental is essential to the national welfare, and it is one's public duty to support Jim's Minnesota branch line, which is running at a deficit.
Reardon leaned forward across the desk. He was beginning to see the links of a sequence he had never understood.
To whom did you ship your ore last month? He asked evenly.
Well, after all, that is my private business, which...
To Orrin Boyle, wasn't it?
You can't expect people to sacrifice the entire steel industry of the nation to your selfish interests and...
Get out of here, said Reardon.
He said it calmly. The sequence was clear to him now.
Don't misunderstand me. I didn't mean...
Get out.
Larkin got out. Then there followed the days and nights of searching a continent by phone, by wire, by plane, of looking at abandoned mines and at mines ready to be abandoned, of tense, rushed conferences held at tables in the unlighted corners of disreputable restaurants. Looking across the table, Reardon had to decide how much he could risk to invest upon the sole evidence of a man's face, manner, and tone of voice, hating the state of having to hope for honesty as for a favor, but risking it. Pouring money into unknown hands in exchange for unsupported promises, into unsigned, unrecorded loans to dummy owners of failing mines, money handed and taken furtively, as an exchange between criminals in anonymous cash, money poured into unenforceable contracts, both parties knowing that in case of fraud, the defrauded was to be punished, not the defrauder, but poured that a stream of ore might continue flowing into furnaces, that the furnaces might continue to pour a stream of white metal.
Mr. Reardon, asked the purchasing manager of his mills, if you keep that up, where will be your profit?
We'll make it up on tonnage, said Reardon wearily. We have an unlimited market for Reardon metal.
The purchasing manager was an elderly man with graying hair, a lean, dry face, and a heart which people said was given exclusively to the task of squeezing every last ounce of value out of a penny. He stood in front of Reardon's desk, saying nothing else, merely looking straight at Reardon, his cold eyes narrowed and grim. It was a look of the most profound sympathy that Reardon had ever seen. There's no other course open, thought Reardon, as he had thought through days and nights. He knew no weapons but to pay for what he wanted, to give value for value, to ask nothing of nature without trading his effort in return, to ask nothing of men without trading the product of his effort. What were the weapons, he thought, if values were not a weapon any longer?
An unlimited market, Mr. Reardon? The purchasing manager asked dryly.
Reardon glanced up at him.
I guess I'm not smart enough to make the sort of deals needed nowadays, he said, in answer to the unspoken thoughts that hung across his desk.
The purchasing manager shook his head.
No, Mr. Reardon, it's one or the other. The same kind of brain can't do both. Either you're good at running the mills, or you're good at running to Washington.
Maybe I ought to learn their method.
You couldn't learn it, and it wouldn't do you any good. You wouldn't win in any of those deals, don't you understand? You're the one who's got something to be looted.
When he was left alone, Reardon felt a jolt of blinding anger, as it had come to him before, painful, single, and sudden, like an electric shock. The anger bursting out of the knowledge that one cannot deal with pure evil, with the naked, full-conscious evil that neither has nor seeks justification. But when he felt the wish to fight and kill in the rightful cause of self-defense, he saw the fat, grinning face of Mayor Bascom, and heard the drawling voice saying,
"You and the charming lady who is not your wife.